Welcome to the Toastmasters Podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gazin. It's an annual tradition here at the Toastmasters Podcast to interview the newest world champion of public speaking. And this year, it's no exception. With a speech entitled Just Nod, Sabyasachi Sengupta earned the 2025 crown this past August at the Toastmasters International Convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He rose above seven other finalists after several elimination rounds that began earlier in the year with thousands of participants from over 100 countries. Sabi, who goes by that name, is a behavioral change expert with 15 years of experience in banking and leading transformation initiatives. As a speaker and consultant, he focuses on the human side of change, helping teams navigate it with energy, humor, and heart. He offers practical strategies that help organizations become more adaptive, innovative, and future-ready. He's worked with major brands including Domino's Pizza, Universal Studios, LinkedIn, ING Bank, Uber, Shell, Nike, and more. He's also a two-time TEDx speaker, host of the Method and Madness podcast, and author of the book, What's Your Plan B? Originally from India, Sabi now lives in Amsterdam and is a proud member of Fusion Toastmasters Amsterdam. He's been a Toastmaster for 14 years and credits the organization with helping him grow both personally and professionally. Laura Amon's article entitled Meet the Winners of the 2025 World Championship of Public Speaking appears in the November 2025 issue of the Toastmaster magazine. Coming to us today from Amsterdam, the Netherlands. Sabi, welcome to the Toastmasters podcast.
Thank you so much. I was listening to all the introduction. Wow, it feels incredible just to also imagine the title of being a world champion. That just feels unreal. It's almost like someone's going to wake me up from a dream and be like, I feel like I'm still dreaming.
Well, that's perfect because I was going to say, first of all, congratulations. And to kick us off, take us back to that unforgettable moment in Philadelphia. What was going through your mind as you literally kissed the stage and looked out at the audience?
You know, it's funny. Kissing the stage, I only decided to do that after I reached Philadelphia. Initially, the opening line was, growing up in India, the doctor, engineer, or disappointment. That was the opening line. My mentor said, you know, it's a good line. You'll get some laughter, but it's not memorable. If you want to do something memorable, think about it. It just felt kissing the stage was thing I want to do. Now, I come from India, where for anybody who's a performer, whether you're a speaker or a dancer or a singer, the one thing you will see a lot of people do is just before they enter the stage, they bend down, touch the stage, and like, you know, it's like showing respect, to like showing a thank you and taking blessings from the stage, because that is like the most sacred place where you will, you, your craft and your, you know, everything is there. So that, of course, has had an inspiration in my mind. I can't explain that in a Western concept, you know. So then you do it with kissing the stage. Now, here is the thing. If you notice, I'm not fully kissing the stage. There's a gap between the stage. And that's just because I'm not that fit. So I could not fully go down because I was worried the microphone is going to snap or the shirt is going to burst or the laser suit's going to break. I was pretty nervous that I hope I don't fall. I don't do anything crazy. And it comes authentic because even though I'm not literally kissing the stage, if you notice that I'm not literally kissing the stage, I'm still a few centimeters above the ground, it should look I'm kissing the stage. That's the beauty because I'm happy it turned out exactly how I thought I planned it.
Sometimes impromptu things are great. Sometimes, of course, they can backfire. People were laughing from the absolute nanosecond that you stepped on the stage. I found that I was laughing, but as you started to speak, I was finding myself reflecting. For those of you who haven't seen the speech, and we'll certainly put links in the show notes to the YouTube video, what's the core message behind it?
The core message is simple. If you want to be a performer, if you have that energy, don't wait to be on a big stage. Don't wait to the stage to find you, find your stage. Wherever you get a chance to be a performer, even in a mundane job or a mundane place, or even people sitting in your living room, sitting on the couch, unleash that performer. Don't hold back those creative ideas, those weirdness, that performer energy, because you never know where it leads. And you'll be surprised pleasantly how much people appreciate it.
I'm still seeing in my mind the movements. Clicker, projector, clicker, projector.
You're right.
I'm just teasing the audience for those who haven't seen it. The speech itself, we know that there's always a process. How did the speech evolve and did it change significantly from when you first started to when you finally delivered it?
So this is an old speech from 2014 when I did it in a humorous speech competition in Lyon at a district. I won second prize. That was my first time ever district in France. I never did that speech again after 2014. So when I got the chance to be going to the final, to the semifinals, I was writing a speech and I wrote at least 20, 30 ideas that I had to throw it in the garbage bin because I just could not find an idea. And secondly, I'm in a frame of mind where I left my job, I had to build my own business. You know, when you're in that frame of mind, all your ideas are around it. All your ideas are around corporate work. That fresh perspective was heavily missing. When you force yourself to write a speech, it's very hard to write a speech. I was speaking to a lot of friends on ideas, and one friend of mine, Abraham, told me, Sabi, that 2014 speech, I still remember word to word that you did. I'm like, but I can't do that. That had all these singing and dancing, and I can't do it. Today, I'm much older, 11 years later. He's like, yeah, but use today's maturity, use today's sensibility that you have. Use it as a starting point. So I started, and except that audition part in the speech, that where I say, oh, Juliet, the rest, everything is newly written. Everything was like from the opening to the finance job to the ending, everything is newly written. But just that audition part was from that old speech. So as I started doing the speech, I changed to what appeals to me today. Initially, it was called A Dream Too Far. And then I changed the title to Just Not.
I thought Just Not was very, very powerful because it brought me back to my seventh grade science teacher, Miss Thomas. And it's funny because she would nod, whether it was yes or no, she would still nod the same way. And you never knew which way she was leaning.
Exactly. Exactly. And besides, this was also a feedback I got from my mentor, John. Like A Dream Too Far is a powerful title too, but there's a lot, the Toastmasters has a little bit overuse of the word dream and these things in the titles. So it's good to stand out. And I remember I told Alan this, Alan came third. Your speech and my speech had a lot of overlaps. It was about dreams and not your dreams not coming true in the most straightforward way, but finding twisted ways of finding you. Because our titles were so different, and I didn't use the word dream that much, it both speeches had its own identity. But if you see the core message in our speeches, and I think few other speeches also, was about the power of not dreaming, or when your dreams don't come true, what to do. And I know there are a lot of Toastmasters speeches circle around that, because in the end, we are all inspired from previous year winners, and we all take some message from that, learning from that.
Some of the concepts could be similar, but everybody has their own story. Nobody has your story. Even if you're a twin, your stories are different.
On execution as well, I think, yeah.
Now, you often talk about growing up with Indian parents and your love for Bollywood. How did your family and especially your parents shape your personality and, let's call it, your stage presence?
A lot, because the truth is, my parents never really forced me to do anything. Of course, there was the implicit pressure to be a doctor, engineer, or a disappointment that was there. But that's for everybody in growing up in the 80s and 90s in India. But I did have the freedom to express myself, to be creative. I still remember in the 90s, I used to host my own TV shows at home, and my family was the audience, where I would recall the whole year, how it went, which was the best song of the year, which was the best. I would give my own ranking, like I saw in the TV shows. I had my own TV shows, and I would make my family the audience to watch my performance and me moderating, like I'm interviewing someone and I'm that character. So India is also very competitive. So it was not like my parents really encouraged and pushed me to do more of that, but they didn't discourage me. But my brother always encouraged me to do things, these things, creative things. He pushed me towards debates and also Toastmasters. My brother and also my aunt, she's no more with us, but she always encouraged whenever I had some creative ideas or I wanted to do something creative. My Pishi, as I called her, always gave me a lot of courage and inspiration. naturally, my grandfather always told us lots of stories. So the art of storytelling and how to keep that engagement, how to give stories that has virtues, values, humor, inspiration, and entertaining. That's something I've definitely learned from my grandfather.
Was there a story in particular from your grandfather that really stuck with you?
I can't recollect right now, but there were many stories. Those stories were when we were very young. I remember the memories of those stories, like being at my grandparents' house, afternoons or evenings. He would tell us stories, especially a lot of stories on mythology. That has a message, but it's also entertaining and humor. And the thing is, I was always a creator. So I had a natural tendency to reproduce the stories to my friends next week when I see them in school. I will tell them the stories. So I was not just a consumer. I was always a producer. I was immediately producing it for friends and stuff. I still do that, by the way. Whenever I hear a story, I come back and tell somebody, you know, this is a good story. I remember the feeling it gave me. It taught a lot of rights and wrongs. And also both my grandmothers, my dad's mom, my mom's mother, both took me a lot to the temples and stuff when I was young. So I heard a lot of stories there, a lot of, you know, in a nice palpable way. So that was, I think, also where I learned a lot of storytelling.
I'm going back and I'm still thinking about the speech. And this, I think you said your parents wanted you to be, was it a doctor, a lawyer, or a disappointment? Was that the three choices?
Oh, engineer or disappointment, yeah.
Oh, doctor, engineer, disappointment, yeah. You mentioned your brother as, obviously he's played a major role in your journey. Is there something that perhaps he saw in you that you didn't see in yourself?
Yes, for sure. I think definitely. In an Indian context, in those years, giving an answer back was extremely discouraged, whether it's to a parent or to a relative. If you give an answer back, that means you're not an obedient child. You're bad. You'll be scolded and those kind of things. I was like that. I was stubborn. I would argue back if I thought I didn't do anything wrong, I would not like sit and take that. Of course, I have been criticized for that as a kid as well. But my brother really took the effort to channelize that inner debater into an actual debate competition. He really, the first times when I was 10, 11 years old, he really pushed me. He wrote the debates for me, pushed me to go in those lines. Like I said, whenever I had these creative ideas, TV programs, this and that, he was the first audience who would always support. And even today, you know, he's always very, very supportive. In fact, I remember when I was in college, we had a debate competition. I was good at presentation and all. We had an inter-college debate competition and I was asked. And of course, I said, I don't want to do it. And I called my brother, I'm busy. I said, no. And he's like, no, do it. I'm like, no, but there is this and that. He's like, just do it. We'll take care of everything else. Just that push, you know, someone telling, I believe in you, do it. And similarly, he told me to join Toastmasters 15 years back. And the rest is history. He's always been the catalyst who has given me brilliant ideas and helped me make some magic.
So talking about Toastmasters, you joined Toastmasters, if I do the math correctly, you joined Toastmasters in about 2011 after you moved to the Netherlands. Obviously, your brother introduced you to Toastmasters. Mm-hmm. But what was it about Toastmasters that really drew you in, and when did you realize that, hey, you know what, this is something that can really change my life?
A few moments. So 2010, December was the first time I went to a Toastmasters club. It was December. It was snowed in Utrecht, and I was really feeling homesick. I didn't have friends here. The meeting was almost cancelled, but then they had the meeting, and then they asked an audience member, myself, a table topic question, which was, I still remember the question, when was the last time you did something for the first time? I went up and I did something confidently and I won the best table topic speaker. I thought that was the turning point. I was like, I am in, I found my tribe here. So I've made friends there. I really enjoyed it. And 2011, November, when I graduated from the University of Amsterdam, that very evening, there was a Toastmasters meeting on the Friday evening. And all I wanted to do was go to the Toastmasters meeting because I wanted to share this news with this group of people. My speech was about how this Toastmasters club has helped me to feel home here. And that's why I'm standing here on the 18th of November giving you the speech on the day I graduated and a day before my birthday, because I wanted to share this special moment with the people who helped me so far. I just felt these were the people. I mean, even if not all of them and most of them were like best friends, but there was a bond that I can't explain.
That's the problem with Toastmasters, is that you end up making friends all over the world.
Absolutely. I have friends, at least this point, I can say all over the world, and pre-Philadelphia, in any city in Europe, I don't need a hotel. I have a place I can crash. That's the level of friendship I've built in Toastmasters within the Europe community.
That's wonderful. What about in terms of skills? Was there something in particular? Skills, confidence, communication, leadership?
Oh, for sure. I think the obvious skill is public speaking. You learn it. You really learn to master it. And even if you think you're a good speaker, which I always thought I am, you realize you're shown the mirror that there is no substitute to preparation. There is no substitute to practice. There's no substitute to learning. Unless you do that, you plateau. And I think in 15 years or 14 years in Toastmasters, I have every now and then felt I've plateaued. I've not grown as a speaker. And, you know, you've seen other people win the best speaker and you're not winning because you're not bringing anything new. You know, you're plateauing. So it is a constant learning curve. And sometimes you don't even have to be on stage. You just watch someone, you see how well they do it. And it's already inspiring to be in that energy. Public speaking skills for sure. The other thing is, I did not grow up with a lot of confidence. I always thought I'm an introvert until I became an adult. I did not have confidence to go up to people and start a conversation. And I'm a people person, but I just held back because I'm like, I'm going to make a mockery out of myself. Toastmasters gave me that confidence that I can make sense. And when I speak, I will make a positive impact and not a negative impact. So now any networking event, anywhere, even in a plane or even anywhere, I am not hesitant to start a conversation because I have that confidence that I got from Toastmasters, from Table Topics, that give me any topic, give me anything, I can make a conversation, make a small speech out of it. That's definitely one other important thing.
So you built your confidence, but of course, we're all human. This year's contest journey almost didn't happen. Can you walk us through a little bit of that?
Yeah, this year contest almost didn't happen because I was in Australia and I was on a sabbatical. I came back from Australia, Singapore, then India, then I came back. On the Monday and the Wednesday was the competition and our VPE was like, dude, you have to do it. Megan, I'm so grateful to Megan for pushing me. But I went reluctantly. I used the old speech that I did a few months back in the club about the driving. I didn't have the conclusion, but I had experience. You know, I know in the end I'll put together everything. So I got second prize at the club contest and two people moved to the next level area. Mm-hmm. Luckily for me, I had a good friend from Madrid, Toastmasters, visiting Pablo just before the area contest. And he was like, dude, you have to take it seriously. I'm like, yeah, this year I'm not that motivated. I just gave up on world championship. It's not going to happen to me. It's too much. It's a black box. Since the quarterfinals, I have no idea how that works, blah, blah, blah. He really pushed me, made me work hard for it. And area contest, I really prepared. And then there were six contestants or eight contestants and I felt I had the room, you know. And then it was like a division contest. I was sick. I was on paracetamol, almost not going. In the end, I just pushed through those 7 minutes somehow and then collapsed on my chair.
Yes, you mentioned this in the article. There was waves of self-doubt, coughing fits and exhaustion. What was it that kept you going?
I love public speaking. I think it was not the desire to win. It was the desire to perform, which I mentioned which is my own speech is all about, just not about being the performer. I say this with honesty. Of course, I want to win. I always wanted to win. But more than the desire to win, I wanted to perform. I wanted to express my speech. I wanted to express my art and craft. That desire trumps every discomfort and any curved ball that comes my way. I can tell this is true because even when I did not compete or I didn't make it to the next level, I have asked for a role to be on stage, whether it's a contest master or when there was every role was filled, I made a roll up with the district director, district conference holder, and said, can I roast the whole event? I will make fun of everybody, all the keynotes, all the speakers. I will just do a 5 minutes roasting of the entire event. And I've done it two times now in two district conference, and it went really fun. I didn't do it because, you know, I wanted the attention. I did it because I just loved the craft and this love for stage. So that kiss on the stage was really because I loved that stage. And doesn't matter how grandiose, how small, how big it is a platform that gives you a chance to showcase who you are.
And of course, the more stage time you get, the better you get at it.
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah.
As Darren LaCroix, the 2001 World Championship winner, said, stage time, stage time, stage time.
120%. There's nothing better than that. And maybe I just add this one thing. There were certain things in my speech I did, and just not when I look at it, that I did not plan. And they just happened. Like my body was just acting and doing things that I didn't know I was capable of doing, or I didn't plan to do. It is just years of practice, years of stage time, years of, you know, you can practice your speech in the empty room and perfect it. But if you want to practice the art of reading your audience, practice the art of getting cues and responding to the audience, having a to and fro with your audience in those 7 minutes, for that you need a room filled with audience, or you need audience. So it's not just the art of preparing the speech, it's also the art of reading the room and playing with the room. For that you need audience.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I had another question related to that. Your semifinal speech, yeah, called Donkey.
Yeah.
There's a part in that speech where you go out to the audience, and that's always risky, right? Especially when you got a short amount of time. You went out to the audience and you said you have a hobby you go to every week. You threw it to the audience, and the audience said, Toastmasters. And you said, no. You said, Toastmasters is the club, public speaking is the hobby. Was that planned? Did you have an expected response?
At the semifinals, I was already expecting it, because first time this happened was the area contest. I did not expect it. And I said it in the same sassy way. Toastmasters is the club. Public speaking is the hobby. At the division, it happened again. At the district, I was not expecting it. I was like, people are going to catch me now. But it happened again and it went well. And at the semis, I got a huge applause for that line. At the semis, I was expecting it, I won't lie, because I was, by now I have seen the pattern, but it's one of those things that you cannot force it. I don't know what I would have done if I didn't get it. I would have probably said public speaking. Thank God, everywhere else they said it's Toastmasters. And Toastmasters probably wouldn't have had the same zing, but that's the little risk you have to take, right?
If you're prepared for that. Tell us a little bit about that semifinal speech.
Donkeys was a speech that where I speak about the three donkeys: donkey of no confidence, donkey of high pressure, and donkey of self-doubt, were my three donkeys that were driving me crazy while I was doing my driving exams. This was a driving school that would not book me an exam, one who would just scream and shout at me, and myself putting extra pressure on me. And I speak about how a tiger once got dragged into a conversation with a donkey when the donkey was screaming, the grass is blue. And he tried to help the donkey, but then got dragged into this conversation for hours till a lion intervened and said, tiger, you're wasting your time, walk away. And that's what I say. I was draining by listening to these three donkeys till my colleague Arnout called me on the day of the exam and said, hey, see this as a public speaking adventure. The steering wheel is your microphone. And everybody's in the audience. I found a lion who reminded me I'm a tiger and I should just do what I am capable of doing. It's a true story. It really happened. And that call really changed how I took the exam, and I passed in one go.
And you showed everybody your Netherlands
yes.
driver's license. That's great. Yeah.
Exactly.
Both speeches, again, humor. Choosing a humorous speech, yeah, especially at this level, can be risky, right? Because mm-hmm. humor sometimes is subjective. Mm-hmm. It could be cultural. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, why did you decide to lead with laughter instead of taking a more serious tone?
You know, for years, I've been trying to do a serious speech on an international speech contest. I had speeches about me drowning or being caught in a flood or a stabbing incident, because I kind of role modeled a lot of these world championship or people who do these speeches, there's always, you know, the death, dying, accident index where there is always some kind of like a very big heartburn that happens and stuff. I honestly felt that's not me. You know, I like to entertain. And as a public speaker, we all have a role. You can be the inspiration. You can be the one who's like the bit of the guru or someone who's been through this hard journey. I'm the entertainer who loves to make people smile. Now, I spoke to Furzi. He had competed the year before. At just 10 minutes before the competition, he was behind me standing, and I saw so many people walk up to him and say, "We loved your zipliner speech. It was so funny. It was so funny." And I remember asking him, "How did you not win? You had so many people walking up to you and telling you this." And he said, "I was overtime by 3 seconds." There is always this saying, people say that humorous speech do not win world championship. And I like to challenge that. Maybe there is truth to that. If it's just a stand-up comedy, it's probably not going to win because it also still needs to tick all the judging form. But I think in my limited understanding, I think a lot of time people get disqualified. That's why they don't win, because the audience is laughing a lot. Now, my speech was 5 minutes, 50 seconds in the hotel room when I practiced it. In the finals, it was like 7 minutes, 15 seconds. So wow. I had 1.5 minutes roughly of laughter. And that is something a speaker should take into account when they're wanting to do a humorous speech. That's the first thing you should take into the time, because it's a very, very crucial thing, because it's not in your control how much laughter and applause you will get. And you should not walk over it, because then you're losing credibility. It's important to stick to what feels authentic to you. I love this quote, maximize your max and minimize your min. My max is humor. I like to make people smile. I like to help people be a little lighter than when they met me, with some humor, with some jokes. I didn't think I can change someone's life or the way they think in 7 minutes speech, to be very honest with you. I think that's very high expectations to have. So do what feels most authentic to you, and making someone laugh was my gamble. And the third thing is what I said in my acceptance speech: detachment from the outcome, not from the process. I did not care so much about winning and losing. All I cared was to do a good speech, do what I can do at my best, bring my A game, do what feels more authentic to me, and the rest is not in my hand. The moment I was trying to be a bit inspirational, bit funny, bit motivational, when you try to do so many things in one go, that's when you fail, I think. Rather, do one thing, but do it brilliantly and see the magic unfold.
I listened to a local speaker once who did a humorous speech around the topic of HR, and it was very, very funny. However, what happened was a lot of people felt that the humor overpowered the message. Mm. Your speech was funny from the start. Was there ever a concern that the humor could potentially overpower your message?
A little. There was. And that's why I started with the audience, because I wanted to make the message at the very start. I didn't want to have that pattern where you do a speech about me, and then at the end, you bring the message, because then I feel wouldn't have had that zing. That first 30, 40 seconds that I did with involving the audience, they'll give me a little hoo-hoo if you love the stage, is when I brought everybody in my story. Now, whatever I was doing, they were part of this narrative. That's what I intended to do. I think that really worked for me. There is that risk for sure that the message can get overpowered. For sure, I agree with that. But again, if you want a speech that has a strong message, strong humor, strong inspiration, strong body language, strong everything, you need half an hour or get overtime. Have everything, but pick one thing that you want to go full strong on. And I think I think there were many good speeches that ticked a lot of boxes. But I think this is the area where I'm going to go full on, and the rest is going to be there. But at least that was what I tried to do.
Yeah, that seemed consistent. You shared a quote from the Bhagavad Gita about focusing on what's in your control. You mentioned that in the article. How has that mindset shaped you both as a speaker and as a person?
A lot, because the moment I detach from outcomes, I'm only focused on my own journey, my craft, my speech. So those 7.5 minutes, Greg, I prepared like crazy. I think everybody did. I'm not the exception. I prepared the opening, that first bit to go down and kiss the stage. I prepared thoroughly. The closing, I had literally two closing in mind. One prepared very well that I did, and one in case I'm going overtime to quickly wrap it up in 5 seconds, basically save time there, not to get disqualified. I did everything in my capacity for those 7.5 minutes. But what I didn't do was I didn't Google any speakers in advance, all the 28 semifinalists, to know what's the competition like, who has been to the world championship before, who hasn't been to the world. I literally didn't know. It didn't matter to me at that point because I cannot influence their speech. I can only influence my speech. I cannot influence the judges. I can only do what is in my hand. I know the form. I know Toastmasters. I know what is expected. I had great mentors. I had John Zimmer. I had Aditya Maheshwaran. I mentioned my friend Percy, who really went above and beyond to help me. That's all in my hand. I've worked really hard with these people. And the rest, with what the judges think, what the outcome might be, is not in my hand. And if I had not made it to top three and had you invited me to this podcast, I would have said the exact same things, because what I'm saying comes out of my love for stage, comes out of the experience of the preparation of the speech, and not out of anything of holding that trophy or being on the cover. That is a byproduct which was not in my hand. That does not give me experience. Experience comes from the process, and that's what I focus on.
So you made it you, and reminds me, I think it was Cyril Jr. Dim 2023, a speech was entitled Ndini. This is me.
Yeah. Yes. Really amazing guy he is. He reached out to me, congratulated me. Also, the world champion community is so amazing. The first 5 minutes after becoming a world champion, I got added to a group WhatsApp where I have all these legends in the chat. And they're congratulating me, writing me messages. I'm on first name basis with these legends. I was like, I'm going to collapse. I don't know. And I wrote to them like, you guys are people I've idolized. I've studied your speeches. And now I'm actually in conversation with these people. This actually means more to me than the trophy, because now I'm like, and what a great community of people. Everybody is so kind, warm. People actually have reached out to me to know how am I handling this period, if I'm too overwhelmed, if I need help. These guys are champions for a reason. They have a heart to give.
Absolutely. So thinking back, if you could speak to that young Sabi who was once afraid to even speak up, what would you tell him now?
That you are like the Chinese bamboo plant, that when initial years it doesn't grow, people think it's dead, it has no potential. But what you're really doing is going underground, consolidating your roots and getting stronger. And the day you get the right environment to go up, you will be unstoppable.
Wow. So folks, if you've been inspired today, I encourage you to share this episode with your friends and family and fellow Toastmasters. You can find the Toastmasters podcast at toastmasterspodcast.com, toastmasters.org, Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to read the profile by Laura Amon. Meet the winners of the 2025 World Championship of Public Speaking that appears in the November 2025 issue of the Toastmaster magazine. Now, Sabi, tell us a little bit about where people can look for you, where they can find you, and also maybe share a little bit about your new venture, Method and Madness.
Let me start with Method in Madness. Method in Madness is a boutique consulting company that I've created. It aims to change behaviors in corporates so they can be more open to change, to more innovation, and make workplace more fun, where people can collaborate, communicate, and not bicker about things. So that's Method in Madness. Where you can find me? Well, I'm in Amsterdam. Anybody who visits Amsterdam, please drop me a message via LinkedIn, via Instagram, or via anywhere. And I'm always up for coffee and to meet. So if you're in Amsterdam, I'm going to be there. My email, I think, sabyasachi@method-im.com. You can find that email both on my website and on my LinkedIn as well. Just drop me an email and I'm always here.
I'm just thinking back. I did, of course, the research. I listened to the speeches and I listened to here today. And you've been on quite the incredible journey. And I think I was going to throw in one more question.
Yes, of course.
I'm going to put you on the spot. What's one thing Toastmasters everywhere can learn from your journey?
Honestly, very, very honestly, to have the humility to ask for help. I don't think I would have come this far if I did not have the support system that I had, the mentors, the friends. And it's not just the World Championship. The first time when I went to the district conference in 2014, my three friends, Cora, Eric, and Victoria, they're all busy in their work and life. They just said, we are not leaving you alone to go to France and compete. We are coming with you, because I didn't know anybody. In the meantime, Cora had an accident. She was on a wheelchair and she still came in a wheelchair to cheer for me. That's the kind of support system I had. Without that kind of support system, it's impossible to come this far, at least for me. Teamwork makes dream work, and you can only build that support system if you're willing to give, if you're willing to listen, and you're willing to ask for help with humility when you need. And I think if you can do all three of that, you will be able to build that kind of support system that I have here that has helped me to come this far in my journey.
That's certainly sage advice. Sevya Sachi Sangutta, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, and all the best in your future endeavors.
Thank you so much. Thank you.